Greetings to the brightest audience in the country, and welcome to Theology Thursday. I'm Nicole McBurney. Every weekday, we bring you the news of the day, the culture, and science from a Christian worldview, but today, join me and Pastor Bob Enyar as we explore the source of our Christian worldview, the Bible.
Tonight, we should finish our study of the Exodus Code, the Exodus Law that Moses, in chapter 24, verse 7, calls the Book of the Covenant, which has for centuries been called these chapters of the book of Exodus that we've just been in, 21, 22, and half of 23, have been called the Book of the Covenant. This is the covenant that God said to Israel, here are my laws and I want you to obey them. And the Book of the Covenant, they said, sure, we'll go for it. Well, they didn't do very well. But tonight, we'll be completing the study, which we've entitled the Exodus Code. And then we're in chapter 23, verse 1. You shall not circulate a false report. Do not put your hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. So you shall not circulate a false report. People lie. That's why pollsters sometimes get the facts wrong. Sometimes their polls are not worth much. But unlike most polls, there was one taken in the 1980s, I believe by Gallup, and we know that a huge percentage of the people who responded to that poll were telling the truth. A huge percent. At least 90% of the respondents were telling the truth. The poll asked them whether or not they lied. Are you a liar? And 90% of Americans said yes. So we know in that poll, in other words, they ask 1,000 people, do you lie? 900 said yes. So they had to be telling the truth. Even if there was someone in the group that had never lied, just saying he lied made him a liar. So 90% of the people absolutely were telling the truth at that moment. So what of the other 10%? If we're to believe the poll, you know, the headlines were 90% of Americans lie. But if the poll is true, then the 10% who said they don't lie, we have to assume that 90% of them are liars. So I always thought the headline should have been 99% of Americans are liars. Unless, of course, the poll is unreliable. But lies are so common in our society that most people do not even care if they are lied to. Leviticus 19:16, you shall not go about as a talebearer among your people. Think of a politician on the campaign trail, and you could picture a talebearer among the people. Hillary Clinton, campaigning for Senate in New York, can lie to a reporter's face, and everyone knows she's lying, and the reporter doesn't care, her supporters don't care, and the people at large don't even care. Not even the conservatives. How many times would a conservative talk show host just make an excuse for candidates who lie? They say, well, I'm the governor and I'm not going to campaign for office. And then you find out, well, you've been planning his campaign for 6 months. And even a conservative talk show host will say, that's what they have to do. They have to do it that way. So we've just all become accustomed to lying. Politicians, of course, lie like rugs. We all expect it. We expect it. So the democratic process has helped bring us to the point where 99% of Americans lie. Our leaders lie, so we all lie. We have a huge credibility problem, and that's a really quick way to ruin a relationship, is to lie. That is, it undermines a friendship. Now, perhaps when I'm done with this story, Doug will erase it off of the master recording. We'll have to decide. But I wanted to tell you guys about something that's happened at our office. In the last, this past week, we noticed that 3 times someone has used our office computers to go on the internet and get pornography. And we've warned everybody in the office that it's not easy to cover up. If you went and looked at porn, these computers, they keep records everywhere. And you go in and delete the records, and the record of the deletion is there. It's not easy to cover up your tracks. And someone has used the computers on more than one occasion, so we were able to see it and went in and saw the dates and the times. And so everyone who works at the office, right away, their first thing is, what is my alibi? You know, I was with my wife. So everybody's got an alibi. And we pretty much figured out who it was. And we confronted that person, four of us, and he just denied it to our faces. And then we've continued to research, and we know who it was. We absolutely know. But that one person was the only person who did not say, well, let me figure out where I was. I'll tell you where I was. I was with these people. I was here. I was there. Just that one person. So sometimes it's possible to figure out who's lying, even if you don't know. But a lie ruins a relationship. And then how do you trust somebody? You say, boy, this is such a nice guy. I like this guy. And he lies to your face. What do you do? How do you continue the relationship? It becomes very difficult. So God says in Exodus chapter 23, verse 1, with good reason, you shall not circulate a false report. Do not put your hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness.
We interrupt this study for an important announcement.
Hey, it turns out that Doug McBurney decided to leave that story in. This is now 1 week later, and I wanted to give you guys an update. The friend who was in our offices and using our computers to get pornography on the internet, and we had confronted him, and he said no. Well, you know, this has really been a vindication of our study in the Bible on God's criminal justice system. Because in this past week, he came to me and apologized from the depths of his heart and said, I'm sorry, I lied, I did it, please forgive me. And that was a great victory. Now we're working to rebuild, restore that relationship. But you know what's neat? We did not have proof. We didn't have absolute proof. We didn't have a videotape of this friend doing this wrong thing to us and to himself and to God. What did we have? We had two pieces of evidence. That's it. Two pieces of evidence that it was him. But because God says that you could convict someone with two or three pieces of reasonable evidence, we proceeded, we trusted that principle, and we proceeded knowing that we had the culprit, and we did. And instead of letting him get away with it and fall further into sin in a disrespect of our friendship and his own self-image, we were able to confront him, and it's ended up really, really as positive as could be. So anyway, that's our update. And now back to the study.
Lying is destructive. We should not lie, except, of course, for a good reason. As the Bible tells us plenty of times, like the Hebrew midwives, King David's wife, Rahab, and others. But the warning of this verse, Exodus 23:1, really moves toward the actual crime of perjury. Again, the verse, you shall not circulate a false report. Do not put your hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. If you'd like, you could turn to Matthew 26, but I'm going to look at a story of some unrighteous witnesses. When men violate the law, often their victims are fellow men. You know, sometimes somebody might violate the law and the victim be, maybe it's a self-inflicted crime. Or the victim, maybe you violate God's law and the victim is the Lord up in heaven. Normally, when men violate the law, their victims are their fellow men, their neighbors. They hurt them. Well, Jesus was a fellow man. 2,000 years ago, he was a neighbor to many in Israel. When we read the law, the Mosaic law, we can see that men violated so much of it even against him, against Jesus Christ. Matthew 26, verse 59. We just read the law that says, do not put your hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. In the New Testament, Now the chief priests, the elders, and all the council sought false testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but found none. Even though many false witnesses came forward, they found none. In other words, they were looking for something to get him on. They were legalists. And so people would come up, they were false witnesses, but they didn't find one that qualified, that could say something that they could at least make a show of and say, aha, we have to execute him for this reason. So they were having difficulty. But at last, two false witnesses came forward. Remember that God's law requires the testimony of two or three witnesses. So that even when men are going to do something evil, they like to make a show of it. And they like to imply that they're being righteous and they're doing things for the right reason, when in reality, so often, that's just a show. But at last, two false witnesses came forward and said, this fellow, pointing to Jesus, this fellow said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and to build it in 3 days. And the high priest arose and said to him, do you answer nothing? What is it these men testify against you? But Jesus kept silent. And the high priest answered and said to him, I put you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. Jesus said to him, it is as you said. Nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven. Then the high priest tore his clothes, saying, he has spoken blasphemy. What further need do we have of witnesses? Look, now you have heard his blasphemy. What do you think? They answered and said, he is deserving of death. Then they spat in his face and beat him, and others struck him with the palms of their hands, saying, prophesy to us, Christ, who is the one who struck you? And so they put him to death. And he did rise in 3 days, just as he had said, in actuality, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up, referring to the temple of his body. Mark, the evangelist Mark, tells the same story of the false witnesses testifying against Christ. And just briefly, in Mark 14:58, the false witnesses report, we heard him say, I will destroy this temple made with hands, and within 3 days I will build another made without hands. But not even then did their testimony agree. Now, Jesus had never said that he would destroy the temple. He didn't say that. He never said that he would build another. But what he said was, as I just quoted, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. Speaking of the temple of his body. But these guys were false witnesses. In the part of the story that they were truly recollecting, they sort of got it right, that he would rebuild it somehow in 3 days. But in the part of the story they were making up, they had little contradictions between themselves. The one said he is able to destroy it. He said he's able to destroy it. And the other said, no, he said I will destroy the temple in 3 days. Aha, he said he will destroy the temple. We got him. But I can imagine the chief priests back then grilling them, saying, now come on, remember, did he say he is able or did he say he will destroy it? He said, oh, I can't remember. How about you? Can you remember? Come up here. I remember. He said he will destroy it in 3 days, and then I'll make another one. So these guys, this is exactly what God was warning against in Exodus 23 in the book of the covenant. Do not bear false witness against your neighbor. It goes right back to the ninth of the Ten Commandments. Do not commit perjury. So judges should have an ability, just as we should as we grow in wisdom in Christ and have the mind of Christ, judges should have the ability to discern and to evaluate a witness and determine, is he telling the truth? Is he lying? And here are these guys on this pretty crucial point. I mean, if somebody said, I will destroy the governor's mansion. Wow, that's a pretty dramatic statement. And it'd make quite an impact. But if somebody said, I am able to destroy the governor's mansion, that's a whole other matter. And it wouldn't be too likely that you would confuse those two. So judges should be able to spot lies in testimony just as we should, even as parents listening to their children. But also, the witnesses on the stand before Christ, if they were honest witnesses, you know, people are told to tell the truth and the whole truth and nothing but the truth. They were very selective in their memories. They should have, if they were called upon to testify against Christ, they should have spoken of his works and his miracles. And I think on Judgment Day, when we see who these individuals were, we'll find out that they knew exactly what Christ had done to set him apart from the common man. And perhaps they had witnessed some of the miracles or even experienced some of those miracles. Instead, they were selective in their testimony. Verse 2, you shall not follow a crowd to do evil, nor shall you testify in a dispute so as to turn aside after many to pervert justice. So don't, now I'm going to now turn to Mark 15. But you shall not follow a crowd to do evil, nor shall you testify in a dispute so as to turn aside after many to pervert justice. Mark 15, verse 6, it was the feast of the Passover, and Pilate had Jesus Christ before him. And we read, now at the feast, the governor, Pilate, was accustomed to releasing one prisoner to the people, whomever they requested. And there was one named Barabbas. Now think of that policy. I'm the governor of the land, and once a year, so I can buy your favor, I'll let you have any criminal you'd like. We can see here that Pilate was not a man of justice. He was not a man of justice. And we know that the Bible tells us he and Herod were not exactly friends. But on the day that they both conspired to execute Christ, they became good friends through the rest of their lives. They became friends on this day. So Pilate was accustomed to releasing one prisoner to them. And there was one named Barabbas who was chained with his fellow rebels. They had committed murder in the rebellion. So some of the Jews were against Rome and they were fighting for independence. And he had committed a murder. And the multitude, so Pilate said, who would you like me to release to you? And Barabbas was there. Then the multitude, crying aloud, began to ask him to do just as he always done for them. But Pilate answered them, saying, do you want me to release to you the king of the Jews, this Jesus here? For he knew that the chief priests had handed him, they had handed Christ over because of envy. Not that Christ was actually a criminal, but they didn't like him because the people were listening to his teachings instead of that of the priests. But the chief priest stirred up the crowd so that he, the governor, should rather release Barabbas to them. Pilate answered and said to them again, what then do you want me to do with him whom you call the king of the Jews? So they cried out again, crucify him. Then Pilate said to them, why? What evil has he done? But they cried out all the more, crucify him. So Pilate, wanting to gratify the crowd, released Barabbas to them. And he delivered Jesus after he had scourged him to be crucified. Again, Exodus 23:22. You shall not follow a crowd to do evil, nor shall you testify in a dispute so as to turn aside after many to pervert justice. Oftentimes, the crowd wants you to do evil. It's very common. And you could please the crowd by complying and destroy your own soul. It's a trade-off. A popularity versus hell forever. Let's see. On the one hand, get invited to a few parties. On the other, burn in hell forever. I'm not dumb. Where's the party, man? Let's go. But this verdict, crucify him, was rendered by the crowd, by the committee, by the jury. Even an evil judge like Pilate was able to see that Christ was innocent. even an evil judge like Pilate. But the committee, each individually, perhaps a defense mechanism working, thinking, hey, this is the voice of the people speaking here. And obviously, if it's the voice of the people, what do conservatives sometimes quote? The voice of the people is the voice of God. They quote it in Latin. As though the people, the majority, will do what's right. That's not true. That's false. The Bible doesn't teach us that. The crowd will often encourage the individual to do evil. In fact, far more likely will be that scenario than the individual encouraging the crowd to do righteousness. Verse 3, you shall not show partiality to a poor man in his dispute. Normally, men would warn against showing partiality to the rich, right? Don't favor the rich. However, God here realizes that the self-righteous would become the advocates of the poor. Now, God cares about the poor. And if anyone is going to exploit the poor, although you can't get far doing that because they're poor. But if anyone's going to exploit the poor, then God is going to come against them. And on Judgment Day, many people will experience God's wrath because they took advantage of people who were desperate. But God also realized that the self-righteous would become the advocates of the poor. I just heard someone in the crowd say Jesse Jackson. And that's a good example of that. Ministers in Chicago just, it's a story that's been around the country the last 2 weeks. It's in the LA Times, I think, yesterday. Chicago Tribune, maybe a week ago or so. A group of Baptists are going to Chicago to evangelize, have a mission. And they want to share the gospel with people. And a number of ministers have requested that the Baptists not come to Chicago because evangelism will only spread hate, a climate of fear and intolerance. And Jesse Jackson signed on, and he agrees. And that tells us, obviously, those Christians who are still naive about his Christianity now hopefully will be able to see. And we not just all be sheep and believe that the leaders are all good. But God realizes that the self-righteous would become the advocates of the poor, and in so doing, they would help to destroy the poor. So just because someone is poor, do not decide in his favor if he's wrong. As a judge, and even if you're a judge in that you're a boss, and you have two employees who are in a dispute, and you have to decide, and the one is poor and the other's wealthy, and there's maybe a financial matter at stake, don't decide for the poor because he's poor. Friends of mine, do not decide for the poor because he's poor. Friends of mine were in court, and a Jefferson County judge called them into his chambers. It was a lawsuit. And he said, look, you can afford to pay this guy. He doesn't have money. You do. Just pay him and it'll end it. But judge, he's a liar. He's wrong. That you can afford it, he can't. I just want you to pay him and end this. And that's what happened recently to a friend of mine in a Jefferson County courthouse. The judge didn't say, look, you know, I know you're wealthy and I sort of heard of you, but you're wrong and he's right. The judge didn't say that. The judge said, you can afford it, he can't. So that's the way I'm going to decide. I'm going to decide in his favor. You can afford it. It's not a big deal. Wow. God wanted Israel to pursue justice. Justice for everyone, regardless. And that's why we have this symbol of our judicial system, which is the woman with the blindfold on. Because justice is blind. Well, in America, that's totally true in every respect. It's supposed to be blind as regards the standing of the people in the courtroom. The plaintiff and the defendant. whether someone is rich, somebody is well positioned in the community, that should be irrelevant. Verse 4, if you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey going astray, you shall surely bring it back to him again. So you meet your enemy's ox and he's lost and you can identify it, might have a brand on it. That's my enemy's ox. And he's headed right into the Philistine town over the hill there, and he's going to lose it. So God says, hey, love your neighbor. Is that New Testament or Old Testament teaching? That's New Testament. I apologize. Is that New Testament or Old Testament teaching? That's Old Testament. In the New Testament, if your neighbor is Ananias and Sapphira, they get killed. In the Old Testament, God says, love your neighbor. Love your neighbor. Now, that's what the Mosaic Law teaches. Well, here, you love your enemy and you help him out. Now, what does this mean? So many times, Christians will read a verse, and then that verse, whenever an issue related to that verse comes up, it's the only guiding influence they have. That one verse, as though it were the only thing that God had ever said. So should we always help our enemy and be kind to our enemy? Should we do that? What kind of enemy are we talking about here? Does this mean that if you're in a war fighting and a Nazi Panther Division tank is out of gas, you're to say, wait a minute, we've got gas, fill them up, and then have a nice day? That would be pretty stupid and evil, sinful. Of course not. Christians need to learn how to take God's word and apply it in various circumstances. Sometimes neighbors dispute over who owns this 100-foot section of the creek. You know, I think I own it. He thinks he owns it. Or whose son is the starting quarterback for the high school football team. So if you have such a dispute with your neighbor and you're really angry because he says it's his and it's yours, and you have an opportunity to do a kindness for your neighbor, then do it. Be able to rise up against the current circumstances and the level of tension that's in your life right at this moment. Be able to look above that and take an opportunity to do a kindness. Even if someone has wronged you at some level, it doesn't mean that you have to be lifelong enemies. We need to use wisdom in this. If your neighbor is a homosexual who lends out bicycles to all the kids in the neighborhood, I'm thinking of some news report of a guy in Colorado Springs who has bicycles and toys for all the kids in the neighborhood. They come up to his porch and they get bicycles. And he's been doing that for a couple years. If your neighbor is a child molester, and you know it, but you can't prove it, and our criminal justice system is letting him get away with it, does this mean that you must help him? No, not necessarily. We should have the ability to evaluate the circumstance. If he's cutting the grass, wearing sandals, and he cuts off his toe, well, then, as my Christian friend did in New Jersey, you can help him out. Just don't get any blood on you. And tell the ambulance driver, hey, watch out, he might have AIDS. And I think he's a child molester. Okay.
Hey, this is Nicole McBurney jumping into the broadcast. We are out of time for today, so be sure to come back next Thursday to hear the rest of this study. To find other resources and Bible studies, be sure to go to kgov.com/store. That's kgov.com/store.